Sylvia, the market's busy looking at data which can serve as possible evidence to help us to decide which of these two theories is more reasonable. Just a quick recap, we've seen that natural selection is not really relevant to deciding which is more reasonable because both theories support it. And it's anyway an observed phenomenon that certain features are selected according to environmental pressures, survival of the fittest. And that just selects certain genes, changing the frequency of genes within a particular population as the generations progress. But evolution actually needs to have an introduction of information. It's not even enough to have an introduction of information. You have to have it such that it causes a major change in structural function. And so evolution suggests two possible mechanisms to introduce that information, mutations or recombination. But we've seen that mutations, being of two kinds, don't seem very helpful. Chromosomal mutations definitely not helpful. Point mutations potentially helpful for introducing information. Problem is that all those that have been observed have been harmful or at a stretch neither harmful nor beneficial. But according to Dawkins' circular reasoning, there must have been helpful ones because, well, you know, evolution occurred via them. And then recombination just causes a variation within a kind within between siblings in meiosis. In recombination by viral insertion into bacteria, there is actually an introduction of information into bacteria, not into the biosphere, but that's not helpful because it hasn't actually caused a major change in functional structure. So it still hasn't caused that revolution. Then we get to arguments used by creationists or creationists of the virus. Huge amount of information that's present in living material. Where did it come from? It's obvious that it could have come from intelligent beings because that's what intelligent beings do. But by chance, it requires a huge stretch of faith. And based on what Peter said in the last lecture about winning the national lottery, it's just as well for us that evolution is so unlikely. Now we get to another argument that creationists use, the presence of design. If you see a streamlined car, you deduce there was an engineer who really understood aerodynamics, and he built that understanding into his design of this car. You would not even dream of suggesting that that was just an appearance of design, but it actually came about by chance as a whirlwind went through a scrapyard and out came the streamlined car. Of course, an evolutionist would say to me, I'm being unfair, because given enough time, maybe a whirlwind could. We haven't seen that happen, but that doesn't mean it can't. Now, Peter spoke yesterday a lot about the art, but I want to go into more detail. And I can't even go into a tiny fraction of the detail of how amazing this organ is. But I hope that after I've done a little bit of, not really justice to it, you should be convinced there's got to be a designer. It's sort of by speaking about the cornea and the lens. The cornea and the lens bend the light so that the light is focused on the retina at the back. Obviously, they have to be transparent. They have to be see-through so that light can pass through them. Yet, they are living tissue, so they've got lots of organelles inside of them, which aren't made of nothing, of course, and yet light has to pass through them, you know, not being blocked by it, being transparent. To get that right, these cells have to, these are the cells of the lens. You can see that they've got nuclei and everything. But to be transparent, these cells have to have an exactly correct water content. Too much, too little, and they'll be opaque, not see-through. So there's an incredibly well-organized pump mechanism. to get the exact right amount of water in there. There's also a homeostatic mechanism to check how much water is there now and modify the pump accordingly. Unless that is present, the eye is useless. I'll pick up on that point later. At depth, that pump breaks down, the eyes cloud over. Go back and just speak about the muscles of the eye. There are muscles, of course, that allow you to look up, down, sideways, whatever. You also have a tiny little pulley structure over here that allows your eyes to rotate. And you know that actually as you walk, your eyes are continually rotating so that they actually remain stationary relative to the earth so that you don't get seasick. You're not aware of that at all. If you had to control that, I don't think you have enough mental resources to be able to cope with everyday life because that's very complex. But that's automated. Now, I mean, that has evolved. Okay. Carry on. Let's think about, just first before I go on to the retina. This is an electron micrograph of these cells in the lens. You see how well they are organized, packed very neatly under one another. And if we magnify it, you can see that they are interlocking sections which hold these cells in place so that as the lens expands and compresses in order to adjust to, as Peter was speaking about, being able to see close and far in an instant, you know, then these things don't fall apart. Let's speak about the retina. The retina is the light-sensitive layer that's you see this light back of your eye and converts it to nerve impulses. Now this retina contains cells called rods and cones which do this process of converting light into nerve impulses. The retina has a dynamic range of 10 billion to 1. What does that mean? It means that it can detect a single photon of light and it can also see and operate fine when there are 10 billion photons of light striking. In other words, it operates very well in very bright light and in very dim light. In comparison, the camera's dynamic range is only 1,000 to 1. That is why, you know, I've been in the Cape for about a year now, and the Cape is extremely beautiful. And as I drive around, I make photographs in my mind. I don't bother taking photographs with the camera, because the camera can never do justice to it. Now, you always feel disappointed after looking at a camera's picture. Why is that? Because of this very point. Now, in fact, that can be kind of like counteracted using software. And I'll illustrate it with a photograph taken here. This is just a typical exposure. And can you see that some parts, like the veranda, very dark? And then other parts, like some parts of maybe the skull, that building over there, are overexposed. Now, what they do to try and get a bit closer to the eye's performance is that they take three photos. One overexposed, so that some parts are kind of like burnt out, but the dark parts are clear. One underexposed, and then one like this. They fuse the three together, and then you get something like this. You can see the difference. Very big difference. This is far more like what the eye sees, because the eye is able to be able to deal with the dark and the light simultaneously. So this just illustrates the great dynamic range. How does the eye get this right, which modern technology has not got right? There is a protein called arrestin, which is shuttled, I'll explain, across the retina of the eye, blocking parts where the light strikes much to protect those parts so they don't get fried up by this lot of energy from the light, and also to mute the image there. And then shuttled away from areas where not much light strikes. How does this protein get to where it needs to go? It is attached by means of a biochemical glue to a protein called myosin. And it's a muscle protein which can then move this arrestin to the place necessary. Furthermore, traversing these rods and cones, the photosensitive areas of the light, are little tracks, like railway lines, that Reston and Myerson, stuck in this flue, move along. Of course, that's not even asking the question, how does it know where it's meant to go and where it's meant to go away from? So there's that whole mechanism there that I haven't even explained. All of that needs to be in place in order for the eye to be protected from bright light. If it's not, it won't take long before the retina is damaged. Let's now get to the conversion of light into a nerve impulse, and then that nerve going to the brain. There are 12 movies simultaneously going to your brain at any one moment. Each one looking at a certain aspect, like the forms or the colors or the movement. And they're all synthesizing the brain combined into sight. Now this quote is of course from 1985, but still, I think it still brings across the point. It says that it would take a minimum of 100 years of supercomputer time to simulate what takes place in your eye many times every second. Now, I haven't told you, I've explained a bit about the Western and Myerson, that was very, very tame stuff. This year, I'm not going to read it for you, and I'm going to be quiet for a little while for you just to be, you know, wowed a bit by reading it yourself. This is what the scientists say actually happens when the light strikes a lot of your cone. Just read a bit for yourself. You get the idea. The point is, it's extremely complex. Extremely complex. It's quite difficult to make sense of all that's happening there. And that is still the easy part because at least scientists can explain this. What happens after the nerve takes these 12 movies to the brain and the brain changes that into sight, no one can yet explain it all. It's so complex. You a little bit of how complex the eye and the eye-brain system is. For me, I could only say, wow, that was a really good designer. Richard Dawkins, seeing the same data, says, wow, this is proof of evolution because it's badly designed. Because any engineer would not have designed the eye like this. Yes, for sure, they wouldn't have been able to design the engineer as well. But his point is, actually, no. The rods and cones are wired upside down. They're actually pointing away from the light rather than towards the light. And so, according to Richard Dawkins, that's bad design, shows that it happened by chance, so it came out a bit badly. Whereas if God created it, it would come out perfectly. Now, the problem is that there's a very good reason why those rods and cones are so set upside down. Part of the retina is the picture of it. So here we've got the rods and cones. You see how they're pointing like upside down. And the reason is that these cells are very active metabolically. So they have to be richly supplied with blood. And that's why they need to be right near to the blood source of the choroid underneath. This here is the choroid layer underneath the retina. And it's in direct contact with the retina and right near to the photosensitive parts of the rods and cones. Now there are actually a few blood vessels up here which do feed the top part of the photosensitive cells. They're not so many needed over there because of the backward wiring. But they cause a bit of a problem, well, potentially anyway, because they cast a shadow on the retina. And we don't want to see shadows on the blood vessels of our eyes. You might say, but I've never seen that shadow. Oh, yes, indeed. Let's see that shadow. Take your finger like this, make a little hole, that's quite small, put it in front of your eye, and then move it back and forth, sideways, right and left. And you should see some lines appearing. Can you see some lines appearing? Let's be quite small. Paul and Adeline should go back and forth. All right, well, but that is actually the shadows cast by these blood vessels. Now, why don't you always see those shadows? In fact, the message of those shadows do always go to your brain. If your brain would interpret them as such, you would continually see them. But your brain filters them out. How does your brain know that it should filter out those shadows and not something else? The brain is programmed to filter out whatever it sees as being stationary. So if something is stationary, the brain does not see it. Why isn't your hand up, Matthew? Because obviously, what question I want you to ask me then? Indeed. There we go. Why can I see that chair? Why can I see the podium? Why can you see me? You know, because we are stationary, so the brain should be filtering us out. Mm-hmm. It would be. Except that your eyes continually flick up. Continually. Why do they flick up? For this very purpose. So that those things which are stationary relative to the ground are not stationary relative to my eye, because my eye is flickering. So that the only thing that is stationary relative to my eye is the blood vessels there, which are moving together with my eye, and therefore they're the only thing that gets filtered out. Right, so, let's take that to the next point of irreducible complexity. I've explained a bit, a tiny bit, of the complexity of the eye. And yes, all of that is simultaneously present. Natural selection would not select the eye anyway. It would reject it. It would be less favorable than something else, maybe, because it wouldn't have a function, or it wouldn't have a full function. If you had just rods and cones, but no blood vessel to keep it alive, no nerves to carry the impulses to the brain, what's the use of those things? I guess the question is now. Let me use an analogy. Let's say that we had Shakespeare's Romeo and Juliet, and we need to convert it into Shakespeare's, and then that's not too far off, same author, Shakespeare's Julius Caesar. Okay, let's accept that maybe positive mutations can actually occur. That is like whenever we print it, some mistakes come in. Some letters get changed and replaced into other letters. And because we're assuming that positive mutations can occur, then some of those the mistakes actually give real words. Okay? So we print these books, and every time we print it, then some changes happen, and, you know, we're lucky. Some real words come out, and as a result, it's a little bit less like Julius Caesar. Maybe it's on its way to becoming, Macbeth or whatever. Yeah. Now, the people who buy the book are like natural selection. They aren't going to buy the book unless it's a complete book. They're not going to buy a book even if one word here makes sense that was changed from there, but within the context, within the sentence, or within the paragraph, or within the act, or whatever, it doesn't make sense. Because it will be nonsense as a whole. So, what we need in our analogy is that the printer makes mistakes everywhere simultaneously just right to convert every sentence, every act into the other book at the same moment. And that requires incredible probability. And that is a simple thing compared to the eye. Shakespeare's books are very simple in comparison to the eye. So this point of irreducible complexity says that we can't really, evolution can't happen by minute little steps. It has to happen by big steps. Big enough to actually be selected by natural selection. Which further makes it, which was already so improbable, much, much more improbable. Doesn't say it's not possible.
impossible.
It just means that it's a very unreasonable faith, in my opinion at least.
Right. Activities, we'll get you later if we get time.
Let's go on to the next piece of evidence which evolutionists often use,
homology.
There are many repetitions of structures, like patterns, in the animal and plant kingdoms. The pentadactyl limb is an example. All limbed vertebrates have the same basic structure for their forelimbs and their hind limbs. So all of them have a humerus, radius ulna, carpals, metacarpals, phalanges. Doesn't matter if it's a dolphin, a bat, a human, a horse, a turtle. They're just a very slightly, but it's got that basic structure. Evolutionists look at this data and they say that shows that they came from a common ancestor. And so the common ancestor had that, that's why all their descendants have it too. Creationist looks at this and says, there was a common designer. He liked that structure, so he used it again and again. How can we prove which is right? We can't. But which is more reasonable? Let me ask you this question. How do evolutionists then explain that our forelimb and our hind limb have the same structure as one another? Humerus and tibia. And we have the radius and ulna. We have the tibia and fibula. The carpals, the tarsus. The carpals, the metatarsus. The phalanges and the phalanges. We've got the same structure. Did? Was there a common ancestor to this and that? No. They will say that's not homology. That is convergent evolution. By chance, it so happened that both the fore and the hind limb happened to come out looking the same, even though they didn't have the same common ancestor to the two of them. You know, it sounds a lot more reasonable to me that the common designer, like the designer, uses there and then. But of course, it's not a proof. But we can look at, you know, vehicles that tend to look very similar. They're wheels and steering wheel and seats. Does that prove that they evolved from one another? It's not. Then we get to dating. Now, how does dating work? And what's the significance of it? Let's first speak about that. I'm not speaking about the other kind of thing. All right, some people think that scientists have somehow proved that the Earth is ancient. Very, very old. Billions, billions, billions of years. We all know that. Now, first of all, why is it important to them that there is some evidence for this? I think you've seen that as I've been speaking, that in order for the probabilities to be at all reasonable, it needs time. So, you know, we haven't observed the things in recorded history, but it's because we haven't had enough time. We can always, you know, have that as our scapegoat. If, with enough time, it would happen. So they need a lot of time. Creationists, if they believe the Bible literally, must accept that the Earth is very young. If you follow the genealogies, it comes up to about 6,000 years. So the Earth seems to be less than 10,000 in terms of the Bible age. Literal interpretation of that. So that's why, that's the stakes. What's at stake over here? So now let's get to what is the evidence that they use when they determine what the date of a rock is.
What they do, okay, I need a bit of space to write here. First of all, they want to date some fossils. They get some fossils and they want to say how old these fossils are. You have to understand that there is only one way to date a fossil directly, and that's with carbon dating. Carbon dating gives quite young ages, far too young for the evolutionists. And so it's rejected by the evolutionists in general. And so they won't date the fossils themselves. Fossils are only ever found in sedimentary rock, which cannot itself be dated by any other method. So you have to find some igneous rock somewhere near to where the fossil was, which you assume is the same age as the fossil. There's your first big leap of faith, because how can you justify that assumption? Alright, then fine, let's accept that. Then we get this igneous rock. We look at
the ratio of two elements.
For example, we can look at uranium and lead. Uranium decays into lead at a certain rate.
As, I don't know whether it's neutrons release or it would at least be a proton release. I'd have to look at the periodic table to look it up. But anyway, it's a natural process because of the instability of the uranium nucleus. Now, we can observe the rate at which that occurs today. We then assume that that rate occurred throughout all of history. A silly assumption, because rates are affected by factors, like temperature, moisture, whatever. And we do not know what those conditions were. But we have to assume that the rate is the same as it is today, because we've got nothing else to go on.
Next, we have to assume that that rock had no lead at the start. So it started with just uranium, and all the lead that has come into existence there came from the uranium by means of radioactive decay, not from any other source.
Where's the justification for that assumption? There's none. There's no way you can know that that rock consisted only of uranium and that there was no lead at the start. But you have to assume that because otherwise you've got no way to go to.
You've got no way to show that there was no other way to bring in lead other than the decay process. So can you see that this is a very flimsy way of basing your knowledge of what the age of the rocks is? Then we get to fossils.
Now, we don't have time to think about how fossils are formed and everything, but it's covered in the book. And the real point is that there are no transitional fossils. When Darwin wrote his book, at that time, people didn't really know much about fossils because fossils weren't that popular. And he said in his book, if our theory is right, then there should be millions of transitional fossils, of organisms halfway between one organism and another, on their way to evolving. And so after his book was published, there was an explosion of search for these fossils. The sea was dredged, the ground was unearthed, and people went crazy about fossils. There have been some things put forward, and one of them are dealt with the human ones in the book. Don't have time to go through it. But, you know, some of the people, we've got our transitional form, there's our ape man. But every single one of them has been shown to be questionable. So, in the case of the ape man, that either it's clearly an ape or clearly a man or a mixture of the two. Because also understand these fossils are normally found very fragmented. You don't find a whole being, often, you do sometimes. You normally just find little bits. And often, bits from a variety of organisms which then they put together into one. And sometimes they even forgery. And there are also a lot of organisms which were found in so-called ancient fossil areas, in very old rock, which are unchanged today, like the coelacanth. And so there's been no evolution in those organisms. So that is a very good reason why I keep that. Another thing that throws doubt on evolution. Recently I went to the West Coast Fossil Park, and so I was looking at some turtles, and intermediate turtles, like the photos, all the photos of the turtles present, and they all are complete turtles. And you can, there's a lot that goes, it goes into a lot in the book, but I'm not going to be bogged down with this time because you run out of time. One, Scott? Well, you're on it, okay. It was a lot of great time. All right, and interestingly, at that place, it's a jungle barn about an hour and a half out of Cape Town. There were fossils of short-necked, long-horned rocks of four-tusked elephants, of an African bear. And in amongst all this, there were also fossils of things from whales and dolphins. And that is compatible with an explanation that all of that was washed up by the flood, Noah's flood. So there's a lot more we could go into, because that's a whole topic on its own.
We don't have time for that.